I love the idea of a forest-themed warlock. You know, my patron is the Great Oak, the one that the Smurfs talk to.
Yeah, I like that a lot. That makes a lot of sense. Live from the Mundangerous Tunnel Collapse in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 202 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're heading into this deep, dark pit to talk about adventuring underground. But first, the rogue traders police the streets in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign. And later, the sapper digs deep and goes boom in the Character Creation Forge.
Are you looking for a great story? Do you love Star Wars? Do you like podcasts?
You said yes to any of these? Check out the Redemption Podcast.
Well, I have less in my head than you do normally, probably.
You haven't met the crew I'm with. Pretty much everywhere we go, our life is in danger.
Things didn't explode. That's pretty sneaky for us.
That sounds horrible.
Yes, please finish up whatever underhanded thing you're doing on the computer terminals at the Jedi Temple.
Check out Redemption Podcast at www.redemptionpodcast.com.
You know, Shane, I think it's strange that we've now hit the episode numbers that are basically area codes.
Uh-huh.
It worries me a little bit.
Yeah.
It's all kind of feeling real now.
Okay. that's a weird touch point for real, but got it.
Well, you know, and also you bought a cat with all that sweet, sweet Patreon money.
Yep, we are now in possession of a podcat, which is currently probably making a lot of noise in the background of this track, and I promise will not be edited out.
No, from either of us. You are in possession of a podcat. I am far away at my place, safe from your cat.
That's true.
There was an article last week in The Atlantic that I thought was really interesting. They do this series on like friendships where a journalist talks to a couple of friends about their friendship. And the one they did was on a D&D group, six guys who have been playing together for 30 years. I think they've been doing two campaigns over that time. Two campaigns in 30 years.
Wow.
Using the same characters. Yeah. One of which is Greyhawk.
Okay.
It's like, okay, wow. Because
that was the only thing available 30 years ago.
Right. Well, and the other is a homebrew setting where they made themselves and rotate GMs.
Okay.
Yeah. And I was just like, this is an interesting introduction for anyone who doesn't know anything about D&D. Because, you know, they sort of like explain a lot of things for people who don't know anything about what they're talking about, but you can see that like they're definitely old school gamers where they talk about like going into dungeons and like killing things and taking their stuff and like saving maidens from dragons, you know, which is just like, yeah, the stuff you did in the 80s.
Right. It's amazing because now like when we started gaming, right, a 30-year group meant that you were like pretty much playing D&D from the beginning.
Right.
Right. Or even when you started, probably was not even possible. Whereas
right,
like
exactly.
Now, like a 30-year group is somewhere middle of AD&D, right? Right. Like they're not even that old school as it goes.
Right. Like they started after the kids in Stranger Things.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, but it's cool. They're like the only reason we're probably still friends after all this time, like real life friends, is the game. Because like one of us moved to Germany and Skypes in, and another person is like, you know, far out of town, and we all have kids. And you know, normally you wouldn't be able to get together, except that like this is the group, and we've always been friends. And you know, here we are. So
right.
I thought that was cool.
This is like our excuse to stay friends when life does everything it can to conspire to prevent that.
Right. And I was like, oh, it's interesting, like the spectrum of gamers these days. And then they end with a story about how one of their characters mouthed off to a sea hag and just she immediately death gazed him. And like that character was dead forever. And I was like, all right, we're not all that different.
You know? Right. That sounds a lot like something I've done.
Right. I think the line was she like asked him to do something. And he was like, well, what if I don't? Dead. All right, so speaking of bad decisions, Shane, where are we in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign?
So the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign is our Warhammer 40k Rogue Trader game played using Dark Heresy 2nd Edition rules by Fantasy Flight Games. And on the Death World Iblis Prime, in the frontier city of Meridian, the Rogue Traders have set out to establish a colony in the name of the Holy Throne of Terra and Prophet. So, having established a foothold in the North Manufactories District, the Rogue Traders of Roth Enterprises now set about holding on to it. You're facing down the local criminal element, the Technogangers, as well as the local mercantile guild, the Peacekeepers, and turn your attention to the thing that you should be doing best, profit.
Yes, but very rarely actually do well. The most interesting part about the game at this moment is that, I think, is that you shifted us to like a risk format where, like, there was a map with territories and we were determining where to expand and, like, spending resources in order to, like, buy units.
Yeah. So we kind of took a step back from the kind of day-to-day, action-to-action, minute-to-minute focus of, like, Dark Heresy. And we were actually using the faction system from Stars Without Number, which I had basically fully reskinned into level-appropriate stuff for Rogue Traders.
Yeah, and then for a hot second, it was basically like channeling Birthright, where you had the camera focus, like, you know, high elevation, looking at the entire map, and then deciding what we were going to do in this particular, like, quadrant of the city. We're going to, like, bring in mercenaries to police the streets, and, like, how much of our profit factor are we going to put in as an investment? And then suddenly we'd zoom in to the character level, because, like, two of us would be like, hey, we're actually going to, like, physically go to this location at the factories to see what we can see, and then use, mm-hmm. like, you know, interpersonal skills or, like, perception checks.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's sort of the thing, right, is, like, the system is the way of managing large groups of people and, like, large long-term actions. But you always have the option as heroes to zoom in and go do it yourself at the risk to yourself.
Right. So on the macro level, we were like, we have that mine that we fixed up after it got exploded by the Technogangers. So let's just put that into overdrive.
Yep.
And, like, not focus on it at all because it seems to be working on its own. And here in the North Manufactories, well, the Technogangers and Peacekeepers are sort of turning on each other, which is great for us. Because the Peacekeepers had that political machine that they brought in, which was, I think, really walloped us pretty hard. So it was nice to have that attention turned toward the Technogangers. And then the Technogangers, in response, formed an armed militia to march against the political organizers. It became very Gangs of New York.
Yes, that's exactly where the North Manufactories end up. And it gets even worse. Because, like, while your rivals are turning on each other, you are now putting all of your newly minted coins into, shall we say, establishing law and order. Basically, by founding an elite Arbites training center.
Police academy.
Which, you know, previously wasn't a district with a lot of police presence. Now you have pretty much total control of the police response in the North Manufactories.
So we have now gentrified this neighborhood and then established a police academy. We are the bad guys.
Oh, yeah. In almost every story, you're the bad guys.
Seriously. I think next we're going to, like, close the community center.
Right.
And, like, bulldoze some families' houses to build condos.
This is why political machines exist, is to resist people like you.
Right. We're the bad guys from the Goonies.
So, armed with carapace armor and stun batons, the Rogue Traders send their Goonies villain Arbites forward and into the North Manufactory.
And we'll find out what happens next week.
So, this week, we are talking about Underground Adventures.
And I think this is partially inspired by some talk on the Discord channel where people were saying they were interested in hearing about how to run games or play games in different kinds of environments. So we'll see how this one goes. You let us know, and you know, maybe we'll throw in a few others in the future. So I think underground adventures happen a lot in RPGs in general because, like, the question of what lies beneath the earth has always been this source of terror and inspiration for humanity in general. You've got you know, in fiction, mole people and hidden dinosaurs who live in like a jungle inside the planet. Dante put hell itself right in the center of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
So like, it's no wonder that it's a pretty common setting for RPG adventures. Like all kinds of crazy stuff happens underground.
Also, you add in like dark, claustrophobic, you know, just the normal sort of human experiential fears, and underground seems to look real bad.
Yeah. Plus super sexy drow who want to kill you.
Well, I don't know.
It's not so bad. Right. It has an allure, some allure that I can't quite explain. I don't know what it is.
At least they talk to you first.
That sometimes makes it worse. I don't know. It's like, I'm being eaten, but also you won't shut up. All right. So I think one of the problems with these kinds of games, though, is like it's supposed to be dangerous and alien, right? But too often it becomes just like a regular session of a game, but it's in the dark. You know, if those drow are just taking you down to their very normal Zhao city where there's nothing strange or weird, but just all the politics is drow and spiders, it doesn't actually offer a change of pace. It doesn't make things seem strange or different. You've just sort of like reskinned a city on the surface.
Yeah, and add a disadvantage for two or three characters in your party when they try to do anything.
Right, and everyone else is like, ah, no, all the races have dark vision these days in 5e. I don't care. All right, so when you are running games underground, there are a couple of things to consider. And the first is, what is it that's actually down there? And I think even before you like try to plan encounters or like send people down there, as a GM, you want to decide what it is that they're likely to encounter. And the first thing you need to ask yourself is, what is the geology of your setting? Because this sets the parameters of what's actually going to be believable for what can exist underground. And it also sets the setting for the tone of play of the type of game you're having while you're down there.
Yeah, so the simplest geology is the one most similar to Earth, right? Is the idea of a solid core.
I mean, it's kind of similar to Earth. I mean, the Earth is flat, but still.
Well, right, yes, fair point. Yes. I forgot that you were an NBA player now.
Yes, I'm very tall and good at sports, the sports.
And name one NBA team?
Give me a second. Nope, Bullets don't exist anymore.
Great, good start.
Celtics. Is that one?
That's one. That's one.
They're still around? Nice.
Yes, they're still around. Yep, so in a solid core Earth, one not endorsed by the NBA, it gets hotter the closer you get to the core. Your tunnels have to be supported. You've got gravitational pull at the center, right? There is a practical, like physical limit to the size of a cave or any type of subterranean opening or cavern.
Yeah, I think this is like the science fact / science fiction type game where, you know, you are explorers. Like this is the type of game that's good for survival challenges or like realistic or scientific challenges where mm-hmm. you're playing like, I don't know, even like an Eclipse Phase type game where you're terraforming a planet or like going underground and mining for resources and you actually want it to like feel realistic. And you know, you have to deal with things like tidal forces and earthquakes, and like you can't just dig a tunnel and have it not collapse behind you because like that's not what happens in real life,
right? Yeah, you have to like pin things and brace them and learn about mining geology.
Yeah, and like, okay, we've talked about this before in like survival type games or Dark Sun. This is a particular type of game where you've got to pay attention to a lot of little fiddly bits. And some people really want to play that kind of game. But, you know, a lot of people don't want to play that kind of game. You know, like we just want to dig a tunnel and like go to a place. And I don't really necessarily want to worry about like, if the geologic stresses at this depth actually make any sense.
Well, I mean, that's interesting because for any of these, right, you can embrace the like geological aspect and how natural or alien it feels, but technology and magic are still potentially things. So thank goodness we invented the, you know, inner rotational gravity stabilizer. And now we can have 500-foot caverns and it's all cool, right?
Yeah, the IRGS.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
yeah, and I think no matter how realistic or unrealistic your like digging adventure becomes, you can always throw in like wacky and wild things to discover down there. Although I think if you're dealing with like solid core planet that like makes sense to like a geologist in your party, then you're probably going to keep the things that you find there adjacent to things that make a lot of sense, right? So there will be scary subterranean creatures, but they'll probably be like crawling and burrowing. They'll have like lots of legs and, you know, they'll eat rock and it'll be a giant centipede or a giant mole, you know? Lots of legs and sapient versions of surface creatures.
Yeah. So then you have the underground ecology, like the Underdark, where you just throw physics out the window. You might have cold interiors and possibly large caverns, like food chains that don't really make sense.
Right. How do deep growth work? I don't quite get that. They're like cattle that live underground and there's no sun. And do they eat fungus or do they just eat slaves?
I assume they eat fungus.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Mycoprotein can work, I guess.
But there's a surface area problem, right?
Yeah, and also, where are these fungi? Like, what are they breaking down? There are no trees.
Yeah, exactly. There's no microecology to exist down here.
Right. So, whatever. Just forget about that. You know, like, it's magic or it's tech or, like, hey, we didn't come down here because we haven't explored, like, deep beneath the earth and we just don't understand how things work. Cool.
Right.
You could have entire civilizations down here, and I think the way that these usually end up running is they're either strange mirrors of the surface, you know, like the Drow or the Dwergar, mm-hmm. Evil versions, or, you know, maybe good versions. Like, I think there have been, like, old sci-fi novels from, like, the late 1800s where, like, inside the Earth you have utopian civilizations.
Right.
Or those civilizations tend to be, like, completely alien, like... They don't look anything like the way the surface is, which I think makes a lot of sense because, you know, you didn't evolve with the sun or depending on it.
Right. Yeah. You have like the civilization of psychic mold, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Like a coral reef, but below the surface.
Yeah. They don't have legs because there's no point in locomotion because like everything's just rock. Then you get this type of underground civilization that is heavily influenced by the planes. Here, anything is possible. And like planar influence can mean almost anything. You know, you get things like the elemental plane of Earth. In Eberron, you've got Kyber, where the fiendish overlords are trapped underground in like their pocket dimensions, where you can just sort of walk into a place and like there's a castle and a sky. Or, you know, there's like an odd hellscape where like a demon has sort of like mutated the material plane around them. But then also like Dante's Inferno is just inside the earth. Like you walk into the earth and you like progress through the layers of hell, actual physical hell.
Yeah. Yeah. As a kid, that was always like a weird kind of conception. The idea that hell was underneath us and like, what does the ceiling of hell look like?
Right.
Like, and it's just like a lake of lava, but then like, doesn't it get real hot?
Where does all the smoke go?
Right.
Is there a vent? So is that what volcanoes, are?
I guess. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. Well, the ceiling of hell, of course, is stalactites because stalactites go on the top.
Of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then there's hollow earth. The typical trope here is like the inside of the earth is hollow and there's like a prehistoric world with dinosaurs. This is really more of like a separate destination. The underground adventure only really happens like when you're getting to whatever is down there, the you know, the savage lands, or you're trying to escape out of it.
So let's talk about some of the challenges that we present to the party when we talk about underground adventures.
Yeah, first one is going to be traveling, just getting around. You are underground. You're in a tunnel, most likely. I mean, almost exclusively, you're in a tunnel that goes somewhere and you don't necessarily know where it goes. And I think when you're running this, or if you are faced with this challenge in the party, typical wilderness travel rules are probably going to apply. Like you can sort of add on them or subtract from them, but like whatever game you're playing, you know, whatever check you're making or, you know, mechanic you're using to keep from getting lost or to figure out where you're going that's already built into the game, I think you can just go ahead and use that. You know, maybe it's a navigator or a survival check. But remember that in the fiction of the game, whatever any of that action that requires relying on the sun or the moon or the position of the stars or like the wind and the direction that it's coming from, or like watching animal behavior, or even like looking at trees to see what season it is, none of that applies down here.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean there's no way to figure that stuff out, right? You've got other skills, geology, earth sciences, chemistry, dungeoneering, maybe physics.
Yeah, like, so you can apply penalties if people are trying to, like, say you're trying to make a nature check, you know, normally I'd be, like, looking at the animals and, like, you know, smelling trees and leaves and things like that. Those don't exist down here. Are you a character who does understand, like, soil mycology? And is that part of your, like, nature skill set? Then great, it works perfectly fine. If it isn't, then you're probably taking penalties. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, throw out different options as a player or as a GM to be like, I'm a jeweler, but that means I'm actually, like, pretty well trained at, like, gemstones and geology in general. I can tell that, like, this is obviously sedimentary rock.
Right. That tells me something. I don't know what. I'm not a geologist.
Right, exactly. Millions of years ago, this was an ocean.
Yeah, right.
Cool. All right, great.
Of course, light and vision are going to be challenges while traveling underground, unless you have some means of mitigating that, night vision goggles or dark vision or whatever.
Yeah, I think, like, there's all different types of vision, I think, is something important to remember. Like, we sort of joked earlier that, like, these days, like, in 5e D&D, pretty much everybody has dark vision, and you're just kind of like, huh, I can see in the dark, I don't care. But remember that, like, specifically with dark vision, it's only black and white, you can't see colors, and it's only a distance of 60 feet, which means that if you're in a big cave, you can't see the ceiling and all the horrible monsters lurking on the ceiling. You also, like, can't distinguish colors, so, like, maybe it's important to know what color this mold is to figure out if it's horribly poisonous or, like, we can eat it, or if it's hallucinogenic. So light sources are important, and there are different kinds of being able to see in the dark, right? There's echolocation. There's old versions of D&D had infravision and ultravision and all different kinds of things. So feel free to play around with that.
Another thing to keep in mind is the 3D movement is a little more complicated than it is, like, underground than it is in just air. Right, so it's easy to get the cardinal direction right and then be at the wrong, like, altitude, right? But it's not easy to just go straight down if you happen to be 100 feet over your location. You've got to find a way further down into, like, towards the center of the earth.
Yeah, it's more like mountaineering, right? Like, it's a bunch of switchbacks. Like, you've got to find a tunnel that goes there, and, you know, it's even possible that that tunnel is just on the ceiling and now you're, you know, half a mile above the ground.
Right.
But even if you can tunnel, like, it's more of a challenge to figure out exactly what direction you are tunneling.
Right.
You know, like, I know this was around here somewhere. Like, we're definitely in the right spot. I don't quite get it. Oh, okay. We are half a mile above or below it.
Yep.
Darn. Food and water. Obviously, it's tougher to forage in general. It can be interesting to have there be enough food, but people end up eating strange or maybe disgusting things, bugs, grubs, bioluminescent fungus. Mm-hmm. What kinds of things are that going to do to you?
And then also keep in mind, there's the constant risk of running into cave-ins or dead ends. So you might go down and find that the way is blocked and have to find an alternative, or that you can no longer go back by the way you came because some collapses happen behind you. Basically, if you can't dig as a party, then you're entering a maze.
Right, and like a maze that can change on you.
Yep.
And then if you are going to be adventuring underground, it would behoove you to find a way to be able to tunnel. So maybe you bring a burrowing creature or enlist the aid of one or turn into one. Mm-hmm. You can summon elementals often. In, you know, more science-based games, there are diamond-tipped drills that might be portable or that you can mount down to the front of your vehicle. And I really like throwing the problem at the party and being like, okay, you've got to get through this solid stone wall. How are you going to do that? And that gives you a really good opportunity as a party to be like, well, I have all these high-level abilities because, like, I'm a really cool adventurer. A lot of them can be used to destroy big chunks of rock. And it's a really cool way to sort of think outside the box. Like, I remember, I think I mentioned this before, I played in a third edition D&D game where I had an adamantine scythe, because, you know, I was an edgelord. But almost exclusively I used that to dig tunnels or to, like, open doors.
Oh, yes, the scythe, the classic tunnel digging tool.
Right. But, you know, like, cutting through rock was literally like scraping butter with it, you know?
Sure.
I mean, it ignored hardness, right? So it's just like, oh, that's gone. That's gone.
Seems like it would have been easier to get, like, an adamantine pick or something. But yeah, sure, you stick with that.
Sure, but I didn't have one of those, did I?
All right, so let's talk about what kind of encounters parties run into underground.
So I think one of the mistakes people make is having you face the same kinds of creatures that you do on the surface. Like, underground, you should face different enemies. It's a chance to have a completely, like, different flavor of game. And I think this is important even if the PCs themselves are subterranean in origin. Like, yeah, okay, you're playing Svirfneblin and, like, dwarves who are very comfortable being underground, but the players are not. Like, all the people playing D&D are used to, like, there being a sun overhead, an open sky, and this is a chance for you to really sort of stress what it's like being underground and what it's like feeling claustrophobic and, like, there's no wind down here, or if right. There is wind, it's coming from one direction and it's coming really fast because it's basically like a flash flood of air.
Yep. The other thing to keep in mind is that things should be weirder and more alien the further you move from the surface. Usually we want to emphasize that by making things bigger, though if you're trying for hard sci-fi, that probably means they get smaller. But things like giant bugs or burrowing creatures, you know, aberrations, aliens, planar creatures, as you said, prehistoric creatures, all of those things are, you know, they're more alien because you haven't heard of them before. So naturally they're a little bit further in.
Yeah. Like, it gets weirder and weirder the further down you go. And I think after a certain point, the kinds of creatures that, players are encountering should give the PCs a pretty good idea of what the environment is going to be, right? Like, if you encounter yet another giant mole, okay, we're actually, like, probably pretty close to the surface. When we hit the mind flayers, though, like, we're far away from where we started.
Oh yeah, that's the third circle.
Yeah. There's six more to go. Besides mindless creatures, there are plenty of power groups that can be beneath the surface. You know, like, yes, it's a dangerous environment and you want to introduce, like, big creatures that can eat the party because, like, that's a fun thing, you know, these massive mindless apex predators. But if you've got any kind of civilization down there, it's going to be run by creatures who are well suited to living underground, whether that is because of their biology, because of their technology, or because of magic.
Or the other thing that happens a lot is that the creatures that are underground might not be adapted for it, but they're willing to do it. Right? Like, if the threats of living underground aren't significant on their own, like the natural threats, then the undesirability of living underground is what you have to overcome. And these are the people who have been willing to do that either because underground was better than whatever was on the surface, or, you know, a chance for their own civilization or whatever.
Yeah, like, I think there's a tendency to make the creatures that live underground evil. Like, that's pretty tropey, but it could just be that they are outcasts for whatever reason, or, like, these are the sympathetic creatures or characters who just haven't been able to, like, live free on the surface.
Yeah, and I mean, they don't have to be evil to be antagonistic, right? They could be insular, right? They don't trust surface dwellers who cast us down here two generations ago.
So, yeah, you can have basically creatures that live on the surface down here, right? And maybe they were cast out, or maybe, like, they're just expanding down here, or maybe they're suited to it, like dwarves, Svirfneblin. In, like, hollow earth scenarios, you get a lot of humans in the savage lands who are, like, riding dinosaurs, but, like, they're just humans who are just used to the idea of living in a subterranean jungle and riding dinosaurs.
Right.
But then you also get the mirror versions. You get the drow, who are the evil elves, and the duergar, who are the evil dwarves, who are also like randomly psionic. I don't actually know what the connection is between like being underground and being telepathic.
I think it's because it's harder to send like a bird, right?
Communicate, that's true.
I guess, and that's always like the tropey thing is you send a message via like carrier pigeon.
Look, so, I'm glad you didn't do any research.
You're welcome.
They can also be completely alien. Like, I touched on this a bit, but, you know, if there is a civilization like underneath the Earth that no one has discovered, then it's probably a completely separate evolution from, like, humans. Mm-hmm. Or, like, they diverged a very long time ago.
Right. Like the mole people in, what's the book? It's an H.G. Wells book.
Oh, the Time Machine.
That one, yeah.
Yeah, the Morlocks, is that
Morlocks. It? Morlocks, yeah, yeah, because they're humans who just were forced underground and then over, you know, evolution became kind of the terrible things that they were.
Well, I mean, you know, you have all these delicious Eloi running around on the surface.
Right.
Like, why not just eat them later?
Exactly.
You don't even need to farm them. It's wonderful.
another trope of aliens is that because people tend not to enjoy going into underground environments very much, they might be invaders who are building their power down there kind of out of notice, right?
Yeah, it's it can be interesting to sort of stumble upon something that doesn't even necessarily have anything to do with it being underground. They're just here so that no one can find them. Like, what better place to hide?
Right, exactly. Than the sewers.
Right. I mean, like, here's the Russian missile silo, right?
Right, yep. And then I think a very D&D themed underground adventure is the trapped evil. This one keeps coming back. And I think there's been like probably three or four of those adventures just in 5th edition alone. But you get the idea of fiendish overlords are down there, or the Tarrasque is down there, or, you know, Tiamat is imprisoned down there, or like creatures from hell out of the abyss, right? Like, they're overflowing and into the Underdark first, on their way to coming to the surface.
Yeah, they're just passing through.
Right.
I love the idea. I mean, I guess this is pretty D&D themed, but creatures who have been hit with the imprison spell, because mm-hmm. one of the options is like you're sealed away in a location deep below the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And like you just happen to stumble upon like this place where this person has been trapped in a hellish stasis for 10,000 years.
Wait, this place? Or is it like the person who first figured out the imprison spell and taught it to people didn't teach them to send them to different places?
So it's just everyone's like
everyone who knows in prison has been accidentally sending them to the same basic place. And if you open one cell, you open the entire like penitentiary.
It's like Demolition Man.
Yes.
And yeah, Overflow from Hell. Like I really like the idea of like a Christian hell that actually is like down beneath the earth, and like we're just out of room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got a lot of people. It's sort of like expanding on the edges. We stuck some people over here. Like, we don't have to poke them every single day, right? We just stuck them in a room with acid and like let them burn.
Right.
And well, now you've let them out. Good job. That's your responsibility. I don't know if you read that. It's kind of like the Santa Claus, but right. Worse.
So much worse.
You are now a bounty hunter for hell.
All right, so if we're going underground, we're probably going to be fighting there. So
better be fighting there.
Let's talk about how combat is different underground.
Hey, it's tight spaces, mm-hmm. tight quarters.
Yep.
Ranged attacks are going to be much less useful, especially ones where the main benefit of them is being able to hit people before they can hit you.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's pretty rare that you're going to be in an area large enough that like having a longbow versus a short bow is really going to matter in terms of range.
Right.
Guns, too. Like, sniper rifles, not so good down here.
Yeah, you've definitely got to check your corners.
Yeah. Kiting, of course, is also going to be a lot more difficult.
Yeah, anytime your mobility is restricted, right, that it becomes more difficult to keep an enemy at range.
Right, although that like long-distance mobility is less important, but the the minutiae of like being able to take a 5-foot step or shifting or like being able to like disengage or move without provoking is going to be much more important because you're often going to end up in melee scrums without intending to.
Yep. And then any area effect is going to be inherently more dangerous on account of everyone's going to be in tighter packed quarters, right?
Inherently more effective, I think you mean.
Inherently more effective at friendly fire.
Hey, spike growth. Spike growth is the best down here. Remember that the PCs, or you as the PCs, may be out of your element. So, you know, it's really hard to hide from something like infravision. You know, you can't stop yourself from emanating body heat.
Right.
You might end up easily outflanked by creatures that can burrow. They could just like pop in on you anytime and you have virtually no warning because like your amazing perception check can't see them coming through the solid rock wall.
Right. Or similarly, like anything with meld into stone or that, mm-hmm. Even like invisibility is just that much more effective.
Right. It also means that they can escape. Like if you're in combat, like we're usually used to like fighting to the death and, you know, being able to block off escape routes, but you can't if like this dungeon that you are in, if all the walls are basically like air for a creature that can burrow, right? Like right. It wants to leave. Great. It just digs through the wall. It's really different from a traditional dungeon. Like goblins can't do that. So you can corner them in a room and then finish exterminating them. The Ankeg can like go out the side and then flank you again and come out the back.
Exactly. He just goes underground this time. Or from above.
Whatever system you're playing, take a look at some of the new options that you're going to have with like gear or spells. And like, you know, a lot of things are going to be limited, but other things will get more effective. So we'll look at a spell like Earth Tremor in 5th edition, which affects
which
everyone
would be the first time anybody looked at the spell Earth Tremor in 5th edition.
Seriously, right. Yeah, like it's not a very good spell. It affects everyone in contact with the ground within 10 feet of you. But underground, that's a sphere.
Right.
So like you're affecting, what, like 6 times as many creatures with it?
Mm-hmm.
We already mentioned spike growth, all those area effects. Walls are amazing mm-hmm. because like they're area effects that you can just snake along a tunnel and not have to worry about hitting your allies.
Right. Another thing to be aware of is that traps are more effective if you don't have an easy way to go around. So either enemies using them against you or you laying traps for enemies that you expect to be coming towards you.
Yeah, like caltrops.
Yeah,
those are cool at low levels, right? But you really have to work hard to get someone to willingly run over a caltrop in like normal D&D,
right?
But when the tunnel's 2.5 feet wide,
right? Thank goodness for non-Euclidean movement.
Okay. And then ambushes. If you are dealing with creatures that can't readily dig, like tunnel their way out, then you know the terrain if you scouted it. You know exactly where people can and can't run. Everything is a box canyon. So you can set up ambushes at the perfect locations to form a kill box.
Right.
Also GMs.
Yeah, was that advice for players or GMs? I'm not sure. What if we put 2 kill boxes facing each other and dare each other to step out?
then it's whoever has invisibility wins.
Right. All right. So let's talk about some plots that we can run through Underground Adventures.
Yeah. I think the important thing to remember here is that you want to evoke either a sense of wonder, like the strange mystery or the weirdness of things underground, or just terror, like the horrible, awful abominations down here and the clawing darkness.
Yeah. On that note, Trapped in the Dark, an inherently terrifying plot for underground adventuring, but this this could be somebody inadvertently ending up underground or intentionally going underground and planning to come out, but now something has gone wrong and they have to escape. The real goal here is just survival, right?
Right, exactly. You don't have like a quest or a target. You weren't prepared for this at all, which is why the challenge is basically like living, figuring out a way that you can actually like travel and then getting the hell out of here. This is probably something that only takes a few sessions.
Yeah, and I mean, this can be as simple as like, cool, you find a cave for shelter from a storm and a mudslide blocks the entrance. Your only choice is to go deeper.
Yeah. And, you know, it can set up longer or more intricate adventures, right? Like, this is basically the start to Out of the Abyss. Mm-hmm. You know, like, well, you don't...
quite literally.
Yeah.
I mean, you wake up in
like,
prison.
You don't, like, play through a cave-in. You know, you just sort of, like, start in jail.
Right.
And, yeah, this is good if you want to play, like, a horror-type game or if you want to drop a bit of underground adventuring into a more traditional D&D game. You don't have to get buy-in for this, right? It's short. You're throwing obstacles at your players and players. I would say always be prepared for this. Like, why were you not prepared for this?
Right.
Why don't you have a shovel? It's 2 gold pieces.
Exactly. There you go. I would rather spend my 2 gold pieces on an extravagant lifestyle than I would carrying around a freaking shovel
for 3 days.
All right, so another plot that works really well is the emissary to the Underdark.
Yeah, you've been appointed or sent to go talk to creatures that live underground, whether it's the actual Underdark or, you know, the mole people, whatever. Travel here is going to be much safer. Like, it's much less important to know how much food you've got. You probably don't need to be able to tunnel yourself because whatever's living down there is more than likely getting you to and from. But these alien encounters are really going to be geared a lot more toward the social interaction, which is a nice chance to do all these like cultural misunderstandings. You can set up the creatures as evil when they're not actually, or vice versa. It's a cool way to take the like traditional diplomat or like noble political intrigue plot and sort of like turn it sideways, where you also have to deal with not really understanding all the nuance of a culture. It's a nice place to put someone who is very well versed in diplomacy or like cultural nuance, someone who has like a noble background or is like well learned in like etiquette and things like that. And, you know, after they've spent a lot of time like being very good at that or having or being successful at that, like later on in the game, you can flip it on its head and have them like still have access to all of these skills, but have to like relearn all of the like proper mores.
Yep. And then I think to make this interesting from a like the cultural aspect here is you just want to think about what are aspects of culture that would change if you didn't see the sun ever, right? If darkness was omnipresent, how would you do things differently in society compared to how we do them on the surface?
Right. If darkness was comforting, right? It's safe rather than terrifying and unknown.
Or like, you know, you don't have as much wide open space as you do on the surface, so everybody has to live in closer proximity. So perhaps certain social norms of like personal space wouldn't, or personal property would be less honored, but other social norms would be like paramount, right?
Right.
Like somebody who needs space must be granted it because you never know when you'll be the one who requires it.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, you can go in pretty much any direction you want with this.
Right.
Why are your eyes so tiny?
You're basically blind anyway.
Next up, there is the classic invasion from beneath our feet. Whether it's giant worms and tremors, mole people again, because, you know, they're very evil. Mole people are terrible. The party must travel underground in order to exterminate the threat. That's, I think, basically like the traditional trekking underground campaign, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we're from the surface. There's a bad thing down there. We're out of our element, so we've got to figure out how to travel. We've got to figure out what we're going to eat. We're encountering all kinds of like weird new creatures and like dealing with the different power groups, and hopefully someone will be on our side to like fight the one who's actually like hurting the kingdom on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
But we're basically alone and behind enemy lines.
Right. So the next plot point is something of like the last dark places, right? So once the surface is completely known, then the last few things to do is explore the undisturbed places of power down below the surface.
Right. This can be Indiana Jones, like researching the Library of Alexandria that was actually buried rather than burned. You know, there's sunken antiquity. Or it could be, you know, something amazing that was created down here. I really like this as a way to do the like traditional Heart of Darkness Marco Polo discovery game without having to deal with all of the like garbage racism and cultural like appropriation, where like you can still have the same kind of game where you're exploring places that like no civilized person has been, but like literally no civilized person has been there, you know? And this is a good one where like you can tone down a lot of the NPC interactions, because it might just be that there are no people to interact with. You're dealing with like crazy waterfalls and like, you know, strangely resonant crystals and, you know, artifacts from antiquity. And then the last one, you can take in so many different directions. There's the journey into Hell's Heart. Whether you're actually trekking into the abyss or heading into the, you know, nine layers of Dante's Inferno, maybe you're on an assassination mission to like kill Lucifer or one of the demon princes. It could be a recovery mission, like Orpheus going after Eurydice. Like you're going to find someone's like family member or your lost love to bring them out of hell.
Mm-hmm. Or at least bring some information or something out of hell, right?
Right. I mean, you could be bringing someone very bad out of there because they're the only person who actually knows how to stop the even eviler threat.
Right.
Actually, yeah, I really like that idea. Like, there was an informant or a turncoat who was going to like give information so you could, you know, defeat an actual demon prince, but they were assassinated and killed, and of course their soul went to hell. So now we've got to go get their soul out of hell, even though they totally deserve to be there.
Right.
And then, of course, that turns into basically like a journey out of hell, which can actually be even more fun. Like you're here and it's awful, and now you're on the run from all of the forces of hell, like hot on your heels.
Yeah, and you can also... Oh, good. Nice. Hot.
Hey!
You can also invert that as a journey out, being you belong in hell, right? For some reason, you are a demon or a devil or whatever. Something.
Just a very bad person.
Some natural inhabitant of hell, but now need to escape to the surface, right? You've turned sides.
Yeah, I dig it.
Perhaps a fallen angel, an unfallen angel, a risen angel.
Okay, so some pitfalls for playing these kinds of games. Very quickly, every tunnel begins to look the same and players can get bored.
Mm-hmm.
Like every battle map. It's this one again. I'm just turning it sideways.
Yep, it's the L corridor. Oh, it's the T corridor. Great,
yay.
Cool tunnels.
Hey, I got to use my dungeon tiles over and over and over and over again.
Right. You can also run into a situation where the party has figured out their tactics and the enemies keep using the same tactics and the problem is sort of solved and you just keep running the same operation over and over again to win.
Yeah, we know how to kill the giant millipede or like the sandworm or whatever. And the fourth time you're doing it is just, it gets rote. You're running through the motions again and again.
Right.
You can get into a situation where the party has no way to be effective. This particularly can happen if they find themselves underground unexpectedly. But, you know, they could just get in over their heads. They were expecting to, like, bring climbing gear and, like, pickaxes, and it turns out that they're fighting demons.
Whoops, should have brought some holy water.
Yeah, I didn't think of that. Or, you know, it could be that you have basically planned this underground game and so have your players, but it turns out you're not really spending any time underground. You are in your prehistoric jungle inside the hollow earth, right? So now there's no spelunking anymore. That was like half a session in transit, and yeah, now we're just playing a different game.
It's like only nominally underground, right?
Right.
Like the ceiling looks different, but otherwise it's just a regular adventure.
Yeah, and I think this is actually something that like trips GMs up, is you're like, this is going to be an underground game, but now I need something cool that's down there, but the cool thing is just not underground at all. You know, we just found a new location. And
right,
like, that's fine, but like, you should prepare people for it, or like, as a GM, be aware that that can happen to you, and suddenly you like didn't get your like trapped in the dark tunnel fix.
So to kind of wrap this up, Ishan, what's the longest, like most sessions that you've run underground in a campaign?
Oh, interesting. I'm going to ignore like a dungeon proper, right? Because like that's sort of a different beast.
Right.
But I would say probably 3 to 4 in a row. Like I've never done like a proper Underdark campaign, mainly because, you know, we don't like Forgotten Realms. But yeah, probably 3 to 4. And I think that was about the time when people were sort of itching to be like, all right, cool. Can we go back to using my normal abilities normally?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was our trip into Kyber in Morning Glory.
Mm.
I think it was about that long.
Yeah, lots of caves and caverns and then, you know, aberrations.
Right. Yeah, I don't think I've ever actually run one that spent any meaningful amount of time underground, like outside of dungeons and whatnot.
I've gone through Out of the Abyss as a player, and that's interesting. You know, I mean, that's traditional Underdark, right? That's like very tropey traditional Underdark, at least to start off. Right. And so, yeah, you get a lot of that, like, drow society. I'm still getting accustomed. Although I think if you're playing about Out of the Abyss, most people are just like, I definitely take a race that has dark vision because I'm not an idiot.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think it was a tiefling.
All right. Do you hear that, Ishan?
No, nope, I can't, because I can't hear directly through solid rock, and I'm from the surface, so I don't know that I need to put my ear against it.
All right.
I think we're all dead.
Then it's time to move on to the Character Creation Forge and reroll characters with Blind Sense. But before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at EvilSansCarne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTCast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at TotalPartyThrill.
And don't forget to join the conversation in Discord. The link is in the show notes.
So this week, Total Party Thrill is brought to you by D&D Beyond. It's the official digital toolset for Dungeons & Dragons.
So you can use D&D Beyond to build characters, track your campaigns, run adventures, share books with your players, and do so much more.
Yeah, you can use D&D Beyond to let your GM share books with you so that you don't need to buy your own account.
Well, so you're all using the same set of rules is probably the better way to put that.
Oh, and the same homebrew items, because anyone can add them and then everyone else can use them.
Yep. Yeah. You can also use, like, the character sheet is both, like, you set it and then you can also track things against it. So your hit points go up and down, your temp HP get increased and spent, your spell slots get marked, all of that stuff. So it's not just tracking who your character is, but it's also tracking your character through play.
I'll say this about a digital character sheet. There's a type of player who always shorts themselves because they either forget to level up or they just forgot that like proficiency bonus increases and it adds to all these other things. And every single time I am around someone who is inputting their character into a D&D Beyond sheet, they go, oh, my AC is 1 higher and my saves are 2 higher.
Yeah, my move is always, oh, that ability that I wrote the name of and didn't make any notes, I forgot that that's useful.
Right, whoops. And I think there's also probably another type of player that is never shorted on abilities. And maybe, I don't know, did the math wrong and their AC is a little bit too high.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they did the math wrong. Right. That's probably it.
By accident, of course.
Yes. Those people can also use the sheet so that they can get their math right.
So at D&D Beyond, you'll also find a bunch of awesome free content like the D&D Basic Rules and articles from writers like James J. Heck and videos from Todd Kenrick.
It's always updating. When people say, hey, I don't know how to do this and I don't think it can, usually our response is, no, it probably can. Just keep looking around.
Right.
You have to attune to the item before it shows up.
Yep. Add it to your inventory, equip it, and attune to it. And now you have the stats.
All right, so you can check all of that out at dndbeyond.com.
So this week in the Character Creation Forge, we are building the Sapper.
Yes, someone who is quite comfortable underground.
Mm-hmm.
A Sapper, a combat engineer, responsible for building roads and bridges, digging tunnels, sometimes getting trapped in those tunnels, and, you know, suffering from PTSD and claustrophobia, setting and defusing mines.
The guy carrying around all of the TNT.
Yep, yep. That's the guy who you want to be friends with, but not close friends with.
Right. Pen pals.
Yeah. I will send you a note from London, I guess.
Sounds good.
Oh, wait, no, London probably won't be a good place to be, actually. Coventry. Nope, that's a terrible place as well.
All right, what's the build?
It is Moon Druid 11, Evocation Wizard 7, Rogue 2.
All right, so from Druid, we'll get 6-level spells, including things like Guidance and Mold Earth.
I mean, Mold Earth, right? Like, constantly useful for someone who needs to dig.
Mm-hmm.
Animal Friendship and Messenger, which is great in the field. You know, you just get a sparrow to send a message for you while you're still lying low and waiting for the tank to go by. Produce Flame for lighting those fuses. You get Find Traps, which is very important because your job is to find the traps.
Yep. Create and Destroy Water, also good for either draining tunnels or perhaps defusing a bomb or trap that has been set.
Yeah, or if you are stuck underground, this way you don't die of thirst.
That helps too.
Meld into Stone is one of those great spells for scouting. You get Protection from Energy and Absorb Elements, which is very important because the bombs you're defusing are probably exploding with elemental energy.
Yeah, those Goblin Tinker bombs.
The worst.
You'll also get Stone Shape and Conjure Elemental, Commune with Nature, Transmute Rock, Wall of Stone. You know, all of those things that help you modify stone to your purpose.
Huh. You can also Wild Shape into burrowing creatures like the giant badger. You can cast spells like Long Stride to double your burrowing speed. You can turn into an Earth Elemental eventually. You can also conjure an Earth Elemental, and they can just glide through solid rock or dig tunnels for you.
Yep.
Plus you can turn into a flying creature if you want to do a little bit of scouting, kind of see where exactly those train lines are going.
Then with 7 layers of Evocation Wizard, we'll gain the ability to sculpt spells, which helps us not get caught in all those AoE effects.
Yeah. You get things like Light in case you actually need to read something underground. Mage Hand to set traps from afar. like we said, invisibility is great underground, so that you can get by people when there's no way to go a different way. And if you're a certain kind of sapper, you know, there's probably going to be dead bodies lying around. You could always animate them to do the work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, dig tunnels, things like that.
Right.
You also get access to Glyph of Warding, which is probably, maybe not your bread and butter, but it's a very important spell in that you can use it to trigger Explosive Runes,
right?
Which is the best way to set a mine, because the Glyph of Warding can be set to go off when creatures come near, but you can also have it not be affected by certain creatures. You have smart mines.
Mm-hmm.
Like, hey, no one wearing one of our uniforms, or, you know, no one who's like a member of the resistance.
Yeah, the only problem is if you have smart minds, so does the enemy.
Oh, yeah, that's very true. But you also have things like Dispel Magic. And, you know, you can summon animals from right. the Feywild to trigger mines.
So, speaking of, you'll also take Rogue 2, from which we will get expertise in Thieves' Tools and Loose Morals.
Yes.
We'll also...
Ask your GM what skill you need for setting and diffusing mines if it isn't Thieves' Tools, and also take expertise in that.
Right. You'll also have Cunning Action, which can help you double your tunneling speed since you've got an extra action each round.
So for leveling order, we're going to start out Rogue 2, then Druid 6 to get some decent combat forms. Wizard 7 to get that Glyph of Warding, and then we will top it off with Druid 11 to get our 6-level spells. And I think our capstone is Move Earth.
Right.
Okay, Shane, so who is your sapper?
My sapper is a druid who has dabbled in the arcane, but ultimately embraced the druidic path, and has the gross misfortune of having made her grove in the middle of a war zone.
Not great.
In a conflict area between
two
nations.
Do you like my Maginot Grove?
Yeah, exactly. So, given that war is going to destroy nature in the area, my druid has taken up the mantle as a sapper in order to try to end the conflict as quickly as possible with as little damage to the natural environment as can be managed. So she embraces using arcane magic in order to help, you know, speed things along, as well as druidic magic in order to help restore it.
I dig. You use the tools available to you.
Exactly. How about your sapper?
My sapper is a survivor. She was a conscript, you know, started as a petty thief, but drafted into the army and found herself at the, well, what she didn't know was the tail end of a terrible war. And so there weren't a lot of people who were highly skilled left. So she was thrown literally into the trenches and told to fight or die.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. And, you know, she realized maybe the best way to actually get through this is to not be caught on the front lines. Underground might be the better place to be.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out that's not really true, because dying in a tunnel is not great and the life expectancy is very low.
Right.
But again, a survivor did what she had to do. You know, studied druidic magic studied the magic of nature, because she realized that that was basically going to be the main thing that she was up against, was not so much bullets whizzing by, but dealing with tunnel collapses and, you know, random, being able to divert streams and build fortifications. And then became a bombsmith, an engineer. And of course, in fantasy settings, what is that but a wizard?
Right. All right. So before we wrap up, let's take a moment to thank our Patreon supporters.
Yeah, your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show every single week. So if you'd like to learn more about our rewards, you can check out patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We'll be talking about wartime campaigns, which I guess we already started a little bit here.
Yeah. And in the character creation forge?
We're building a Scorpion. You know, General Scorpion?
Yeah, it feels a little bit like we swapped our character creation forges for these two episodes.
Yeah, maybe. Scorpion lives underground, right? Yeah, sure.
Right. Well, that's it for episode 202 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.
Total Party Thrill is also brought to you this week by Kobold Press.
If your 5th edition adventures take you deep into the dark woods, you'll want to check out the 5e Margreave Player's Guide from Kobold Press. The old Margreave Forest is an ancient wood filled with magic, treasures, and danger. It's what I look for in my woods, my old woods.
Good, because this book gives you everything you need to journey into the Margreave or the forest in your favorite campaign setting.
Like the Fangorn?
Yeah.
Eh? The Mirkwood?
The Mirkwood?
Yeah, I'm dropping hot knowledge about forests.
Uh-huh.
So you'll also get 3 new playable races and forest-themed class options for barbarians, clerics, druids, rangers, rogues, warlocks, and wizards. I love the idea of a forest-themed warlock. You know, my patron is the Great Oak, the one that the Smurfs talk to.
Yeah, I like that a lot. That makes a lot of sense. You'll also find 13 new companion beasts, 6 new feats, and 45 new spells.
There are new magic items, including a Bracelet of the Fire Tender, the Circlet of Holly, and the Sickle of Thorns.
So look for the Margreave Player's Guide for 5th edition at your local game store or buy it online at koboldpress.com.